creating this environment. People these days, you hear people talking about creating safe spaces. I'm not sure that's what we're creating. I think we're creating a space where people can take risks. But there's a need for that in our culture. And that's what Theater of War strives to do.
This is SITREP, the New York City Department of Veterans Services podcast, where we aim to inform and inspire by bringing you the stories of New York City veterans, military service members, their families, and civilian supporters. I'm your host, Gabe Ramos, U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Deputy Press Secretary here at DVS. On today's episode, we chat with Brian Dorries, Artistic Director of Theater of War. Brian talks about the power of presenting dramatic readings of ancient Greek plays and about the healing that comes from being made uncomfortable. We also hear from Navy veteran and DVS outreach specialist Monique Rada. Monique shares how she's connected with Brian's work, both as a representative of the agency and as a Black woman. Enjoy the show. All right, so we are here with Brian Dorries from Theater of War. Brian is a writer, director, and translator. He's currently serving as the Artistic Director of Theater of War Productions. Brian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, really, really excited to have you on board. So I guess we could just start pretty much with Theater of War. Obviously, that's kind of your main thing. So if you could just kind of talk about what is Theater of War for the folks who don't know what it is.
Sure. So Theater of War is a project that was based on a wild hunch that ancient Greek war plays that were written by a general 2,500 years ago named Sophocles about experiences that those who've been to war or cared for those who have been to war intrinsically understand would have something powerful to say to contemporary military audiences. And I think even more critically that contemporary military audiences, those who'd served in the recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, would have something powerful to say about the plays. So that was the idea. At the time we got started, I didn't know a single person in the military. I was just sort of this, you know, classics nerd with a kind of an idea, a vision for how these ancient plays might be of service. I'm the son of two psychologists, full disclosure. So when you mix those two things with classics, you basically get the project.
Yep.
And it took me about a year and a half to convince anyone in the military that this would be a good idea. I didn't know the codes. I didn't know how to speak to people. I didn't really even know, you know, how to show reverence or deference in a way that would be received. And so
right.
Just trial and error, having a lot of doors shut in my face, I'm yeah. slammed. But eventually I've met a Navy psychiatrist named William Nash, Bill Nash, who kind of really authored the field in the military on moral injury. And at the time, he had served as a psychiatrist in the Second Battle of Fallujah and when it was embedded with Marines and had been doing, he was the head of the OSCAR program, the Combat Operational Stress Control program in the Marine Corps. And I got in touch with him and I said, I've got these ancient Greek plays that I think would speak to Marines. And I'd read about him in the New York Times where he had talked about one of the plays that we wanted to perform just
yeah.
by coincidence. And so he said, well, I can give you an audience of 400 or 500 Marines and their spouses in San Diego. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'll figure it out. So 6-7 months later, we flew out to San Diego with a bunch of actors, some of them well-known, Jesse Eisenberg, who went on to star in The Social Network, and David Strathairn, who's an Oscar nominee for Good Night and Good Luck. And we performed 6 scenes from 2 ancient Greek war plays for 400-500 Marines and their spouses in a Hyatt ballroom in San Diego at a combat stress control conference, the second one ever. And you know, we did it full throttle, believing that, you know, the audience would have something to say. And during the performance, you could have heard a pin drop.
Right.
And I saw Marines leaning forward in their seats and listening to the play with a kind of a level of attention I'd never seen in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
It was as if these stories about wounded warriors struggling for dignity and struggling to be whole, both from physical and psychological wounds, what they were saying was of life and death significance to these Marines. And you could see some Marines sort of watching through their cracks in their fingers and others holding their spouse's hands really tightly. And some were crying. And we got to the end, and I didn't know how to talk to Marines. But I got up in front of them, and I asked if it resonated with them. Mm. And we scheduled a 45-minute discussion that night, and the discussion lasted 3.5 hours and had to be cut off at midnight. And scores of people, dozens of people, Marines and their spouses spoke. And when they spoke, they quoted lines from these ancient plays as if they'd known them their entire lives. And of course, in a certain way, they had, because they'd lived the experiences these plays describe. Right. And it was then that we saw that we'd stumbled across a really powerful ancient military tool that was developed in ancient Greece by a highly militarized democracy to help communalize the experience of war by giving it a language, by creating a space for people to come together and acknowledge what they've been through, creating a bridge between civilians and those who'd served. And at the time, it was seen, as I'm sure you know, as a career-ending gesture in the military or in the Marine Corps at the time, 2008, to raise your hand and say in an open public forum, I'm struggling with an invisible wound. But something about watching an ancient depiction of a warrior like Ajax, who loses his best friend in the Trojan War and is betrayed by his command and comes unraveled with grief and with loss and with exhaustion and with a moral injury that's so deep that he's not even aware of what he's feeling. Right. Something about that created a space where Marines could get up and talk about it. And so I think it was partially just having the right tool at the right time.
Well, not to cut you off, you say, you know, the right tools in the right time. I think there's something unique, obviously, about the way that you put on these performances.
Yeah.
You know, so when folks hear performance, they figure, you know, Broadway, going to a play.
Yeah.
So if you could just talk a little bit about what is so unique about these performances, other than the fact that it's obviously, you know, dramatic Greek plays.
Yeah, I mean, I think when people hear what we're talking about or they see a flyer, they think people in togas with like battle axes and pyrotechnics. You know, or they have some bad high school memory of what Greek tragedy might have been, or and then when they get to see a performance, or what we call a performance, it's often four actors sitting at a table with microphones and scripts reading, and they think, oh, this couldn't possibly be any good. But that's just what it is. It's stripping all of that stuff away, so we don't interpret the play for the audience.
Right.
And in fact, we ask the audience to interpret the play for us and for each other. And our position is that the audience with skin in the game knows more than we do, always.
Mm-hmm.
And military audiences, which was our first, you know, we have 22 projects now that have grown out of theater of war, and they touch upon so many different social issues. But the military, which is this grand social experiment, brings people from all walks of life together in this way that no other thing in our country does, maybe in the world does, with the level of diversity that you see. The military was this incredibly fertile place where we put this idea to the test, and we learned from the audience what it is we were actually doing.
Mm.
It was as if I had this idea, I translated the play from ancient Greek and I thought I knew what it meant, but we needed the military to actually translate it for us. So part of that is we do the performance, and it's actors, you know, ripping out their vocal cords and projectile crying from the table in a way that completely catches the audience off guard, even in the even if you were a theater going person, and that's a very small percentage of Americans right now, less than 10% have seen a play since the last study by the NEA in this year, and that's from like the sort of Christmas pageant to the Broadway. You know, you wouldn't necessarily see this type of acting, where the actor is trying to actually serve the audience by actually using their imagination, but also all of their skills to give voice to what the people in the audience may not be able to express, but need to express.
Yep.
And so in effect, it sort of moves the walls of the room back and creates this space where if the actor has gone to this incredibly extreme place, then we are basically saying to the audience, well, we've already gone there. So if you want to meet us halfway, we've created a space where that's possible.
Absolutely.
And what military audiences have said about seeing it, I mean, one of the first performances we did for a military audience was at a force health protection conference.
Mm-hmm.
This military couple, this army couple, they came up to us and they said, this wasn't high poetry or classical drama. This was kitchen sink real. I said this to my spouse in our kitchen. These are the things we screamed at each other in our kitchen. Right. And I think, so we dispel all the pretension and all the sort of elite sort of cultural capital, and we just lay bare this story with some of the best actors on the planet working for us. We have over 250 actors, and they blast the audience. If they blast the audience hard enough, then the audience returns in kind.
Yeah.
And exceeds the actors in the intensity of the emotion that's expressed, exceeds the play in the beauty of the things that are said, and the sort of rhetorical structure of how they're said, and this really magical thing takes place. So the performance is 35-40 minutes. The discussion lasts at least twice as long, often, and the discussion is the objective of theater of war.
Right.
But it's also the performance.
Well, if the performance is kind of like the goal of the theater of war is the discussion, and then what kind of comes out from this.
That's right.
The performance is just kind of the conduit. Okay, how are we going to get to that space? How are we going to make this possible to happen?
Exactly. And I think the same way that people who serve in the military know, it's really not about them. Hmm. It's about their unit. Or it's about what they're trying to achieve. The actors who work for us, most of them, we've had a few who don't get that it's not about them, but most of them understand that they're trying to do something of service, and really, it's not even about how good or bad their performance is. It's their job is to come in pretty much unrehearsed and just rip it open.
Yep.
And then if they've done their job, they've maybe embarrassed themselves in the process, right? I mean, the note that I give actors before they go on is make them wish they'd never come. Now, that's kind of a sadistic thing to say, because most of our audiences in the military context, when we were touring a lot the DOD, were voluntold, which is to say audiences that were compelled by commanding officers to attend. So to make a group that already didn't want to be there not want to be there more, right, is a sadistic. But the idea is simply, if we can create a moment where everyone in the room is uncomfortable, then we can talk about why we're so uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
But if we don't push the audience to that place, then we'll always find ways to avoid talking about it. And I think that goes not just for the military, but like just the whole human species. We are completely avoidant of these issues, especially around mental health, of acknowledging what's already in the room. So the role of the actor is to sort of acknowledge it, name it, create a space where we can talk about it. And sometimes the worst performances have been in some ways the most helpful, because they've inspired audience members to take the risk of not sounding brilliant.
Yeah.
So the model works against the grain of what you think of when you think of theater and how it's consumed in the contemporary world. You pay money, you go see a play. It's about veterans. It's about their suffering. And then afterwards you've checked the box, you've consumed that play and how educated you are about the issue. No, this is about disrupting and sort of upending everyone's, you know, sort of presumed notions about their positions on all of this.
Yeah. So I think obviously there's a bunch there that I really connected with, but the main thing is when I think of theater of war, it's raw.
Yeah.
Right. So the performances are raw. The way that the actors are engaging with the script, with the dialogue is raw. And like you said, it pushes you to that place of just absolute discomfort. Which, like you said, it speaks to that, you know, we're all kind of walking around trying to figure out how to live in this world, how to exist as human beings. Oftentimes, you know, there's kind of a way that we're told we have to be, there's a way that we have to interact with folks. And there's something about the performance, the way it's delivered, and the way that it just pushes people back on their heels, it is really just, I think, super powerful. One of the things that it reminds me of is it's like going to like a big group session.
Yeah.
You know, I go to a group session with my therapy group, and it's like you go in there and you're just talking about the rawest things that you've experienced. You know, sometimes you're just mad, sometimes you're sad, but it's just kind of unloading. And then what that does, like you said, it allows people to say, well, they've gone there, so now I need to go there. I need to meet them where they're at.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, I don't call it therapy because I'm not a therapist. I'm just a theater director. And I don't want to pretend like it's some kind of elixir. I think of theater of war as a door. And it's like the widest end of the public health, mental health funnel. And people choose to walk through the door. We don't coerce them. I mean, maybe the general compels people to come. But what's so good about a voluntold audience or a mandatory audience, and I wish we could do this just the general population. I wish we had the power to compel people to come, because then we get the unconverted. We get the people who think that suicidal ideation is a sign of weakness. We get people who have sort of fixed notions of masculinity that are actually toxic to them and the people around them. We get people that we need to reach with this message, which is, and the message isn't some moral. It's just the capacity with a community in a room to question. Mm-hmm. And to acknowledge our uncertainty and to acknowledge the fragility of human existence. And veterans know this more than any other audience. I mean, we've experienced it in prison. We've experienced it in hospice with our other project. We experience it in housing projects. We experience it with people who are gang affiliated. But veterans, to me, are, at least, especially this generation, this millennial generation coming back from the current conflicts, are uniquely in this position to, I think, help others to remind others and express to others a certain fragility to human, the possibility of human happiness. Yeah. And they know the stakes. Yep. And so when they see Greek drama, it's not some highfalutin thing. It's like all of a sudden, it's like, no, that's actually the stakes of our existence when we're in combat. That's what we yearn for and miss now that we're back. Absolutely. The sense of meaning and purpose where everything is of life and death significance. So I would say the other thing that's really powerful about it, as we've been discovering it and we're still discovering it, is it creates a place where veterans don't have to expend enormous amounts of energy to communicate with civilians. The actors have expended all this enormous energy, and it creates this field where in the space, a veteran can then say, I recognize that, I relate to that. And it creates this bridge. I've talked to so many veterans who say, I want to talk to civilians, but it drains me every time I have to to explain to them, to try to. So it creates this space. And this question of like, what is the responsibility of the civilian who is listening to the veteran share their perspective and story? And in the beginning of Theater of War, 350 performances ago, when we're just coming out of the gates, I thought it was just to listen, to bear witness, to not judge, to be present. But then something really powerful happened, which is that civilians started to meet the veterans.
Right.
And meet them in a place of moral distress, which is to say, a lot of the stories we heard from veterans were things about uncertainty, about, I remember very vividly, we were at an early performance that was mixed audience in the University of Virginia in Charlottesville and this 800-seat theater, and this Army captain spoke about his experience receiving faulty intelligence and ordering a missile strike in Iraq, and unbeknownst to him, until he got the report, killing a family with children the same age as his children back home. And that was the moral injury, the moral distress that haunted him when he returned to his own children. It wasn't the physical trauma of being blown up or the emotional trauma of losing buddies over there. It was having done something that went against the grain of his own moral compass, but not have any capacity to stop it from taking place. What is the responsibility of the civilian? We're going to have a real conversation. We're going to get past like veteran 101, like how do we talk to each other and what do I say? We're going to get to the real thing.
Right.
And in the beginning, I thought it was just to listen, but then civilians started to meet veterans. And one of the first times it happens, it was a doctor who admitted malpractice in one of our discussions. And she stood up and she said, I am a physician in this community. It was in Oregon. And I have veterans who've come to my practice complaining about symptoms that could only be related to psychological issues they were struggling with from the service in the war. And I have actively ignored their symptoms for fear politically that if I helped them, I'd be aiding the war effort. Mm. And then she broke down in front of these other veterans who were in the room, mostly veterans, started to cry. And she says, I now, hearing your stories, realize how profoundly wrong I was. And I promise you I'll never do it again. Now this, and I know you probably have, you could spend 10 podcasts talking about the issues that this current cohort have with thank you for your service.
Yep.
You know, and the problem with sort of facile expressions of solidarity with veterans by a largely apathetic civilian population that has cost them almost nothing over the last 18 years. But when that woman said that and put her own practice on the line,
right,
she was taking the same type of risk that the Marine that first performance was taking when in front of his command he got up, or Sergeant Major Ronald Green, who was then not Sergeant Major in the Marine Corps, got up and took on a comment that was made by one of the general's wives, the assistant commandant's wife, and real conversation took place. But when people put things on the line, and when the veterans heard this woman, this doctor speak, they circled around her afterwards and they said, I heard one of them say, thank you so much. That was so much better than thank you for your service.
Absolutely.
Because she risked something.
Yeah.
And so creating this environment, people these days, you hear people talking about creating safe spaces. I'm not sure that's what we're creating. Mm-hmm. I think we're creating a space where people can take risks. But there's a need for that in our culture.
Definitely.
And that's what theater of war strives to do.
Yeah. And I think one of the, to that point, one of the things that always strikes me in these performances is at the end, and I hope I'm not giving away any spoilers, is when you make it a point to say, you're not alone now and across time.
It's the public health message of doing this, but it's the public health message of group therapy, mm-hmm. is we're not alone in this room.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right?
And the one thing that I have learned at listening to audiences over the last 10 years that's so clear is that the experience of trauma, the experience of moral distress, the experience of moral injury has one uniform effect on human beings, which is to make them feel that they are the only people on the planet to have ever felt this isolated, this ashamed,
yep.
this much in pain, this consumed pain, and that no one else could possibly understand that pain. And you hear the veterans sort of adaptively saying, no one can understand except my buddies, no one can understand. But that goes to almost everyone who experiences any form of trauma.
Absolutely.
That adaptive sort of self-isolation. And so in a group setting, it dispels it in the room. But when you use an ancient Greek play as the catalyst, it turns out that it dispels it on another level, which yep. is to say, you're not the only person in this room who hasn't felt, is, you know, the only person who's ever felt this way. You're also not special in the fact that people for thousands of years have felt this sense of isolation.
Yeah.
And I see, and again, I have imbibed my own, well, I learned recently that Jonestown, they didn't drink Kool-Aid, they didn't have the funds to actually get Kool-Aid, but I've imbibed my own, you know, rhetoric, but I see, and I can tell you anecdotally, just so many instances where people come up and they seem, you know, they're buzzing, they're activated, they're emotional, but they seem relieved,
yeah.
unburdened, to have made that recognition. And I feel like if that's the one service we can deliver to people who have felt isolated because of trauma or because of loss or because of moral distress, or because of just sheer exhaustion,
yeah.
Then I think, you know, we'll have fulfilled our mission.
Definitely. And I think that, like you said, there's something so unifying about being in the room. It makes me think of like the way that the you know, it just all of a sudden, at least, you know, the few times that I've been in there, it's like it starts to kind of make sense, you know? So it's like, you know, I think of like Joseph Campbell and the Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Absolutely.
And it's like, you know, the journey kind of going from, you know, the departure or status quo to the departure, the trials.
Ordeals,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, all of that stuff. Yeah. And it's like, oh, no, this is not just my own journey, or this is not my own path that I've been on. This is everyone's in some form or fashion, whether it's in war, combat, in service, as a doctor, as a nurse, as whatever. We're all kind of trying to figure this thing out together.
I do think, I'll just add one last thing, which is I do think that what our culture struggles with, there's so many things. And I think this young generation coming up is really challenging it. We all practice a kind of willful emotional detachment. You don't have to be a Marine to practice emotional detachment. You don't have to be a police officer or work in corrections or be an EMT or even a lawyer to be pretend like you're dispassionate about things that actually touch you to your soul.
Yeah.
We do it every day walking home from work. We do it in urban places like New York City just to get by, mm-hmm. just to, you know, we have our own problems to deal with. And I don't think it's wrong. I think it's adaptive. But I think what the Greeks knew that we have yet to fully realize as a culture, we do it in group setting, we do it in like a one-on-one clinical setting, but they did it en masse. One third of the population of Athens, the citizens, that's another story, but the citizens all sitting out in the center of the city, collectively acknowledging that actually, no, now is the time when we will feel what it is appropriate to feel, that we've been adaptively protecting ourselves from feeling. It's not adaptive when the bullets are flying or the torpedo is heading at your ship to be crying. But it is toxic to defer that forever. And so that, I think that is what theater emerged as a human tool, as a human technology to address.
Yeah.
We needed a way as a species to communalize these traumatic experiences, to create spaces where communities, the tribe, the village, the city, the polis could come together and collectively heal. And there aren't those kind of healing spaces in our culture right now.
Right.
And we're all the more isolated by our technologies that we have that have connected us. And I'm not against those, I'm not a Luddite, but it just strikes me, one of the reasons the theater of war seems to continue to sort of proliferate in all these different ways is there's a need.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so you talk about that need and you talk about communities, obviously. So was it March 2017, you were appointed as the public artist in residence here in New York City. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of receiving that appointment and what the your mindset was in terms of, okay, this is my vision that I want to accomplish over the next 2 years.
Yeah.
And then the collaborative process of kind of working with us as an agency at DVS.
So I was appointed public artist in residence for the city of New York. It's a joint program with the Department of Cultural Affairs and then with other agencies, in this instance, Department of Veterans Services, led by Commissioner Lori Sutton, who's been a collaborator of ours and partner and friend for well over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so in effect, what it did for us for about 8 years prior to 2017, we were a nomadic theater group, but we were based in New York and we were mostly performing in the middle of America or internationally. Mm. And it gave us the privilege of working in New York City and turned New York City into our laboratory, not just for going deeper in veterans community, but also for addressing other social issues. The privilege of that, and especially with this particular administration and this particular agency, is there was a mandate sort of placed upon us, which we were glad to have, to serve underserved populations.
Right.
So it gave us the privilege of going deeper and deeper and deeper into underserved communities and places. So East New York and Mott Haven and Brownsville and Rockaways, and the list goes on and on and on, where we ended up doing this work. And we did work in places like, we performed in Rikers Island multiple times. We performed at Lincoln Center. We did the full gamut, but the goal was to really reach a wide swath of New Yorkers and veterans, but also the community that they're engaged with, rather than seeing it as two separate things. And one of the biggest takeaways, and this was huge, I didn't understand this until we were, and it was something that sort of blew me away, is, we've been trying to reach veterans in New York City for years, and we had a lot of success in these sort of very concentrated ways, especially with organizations, getting them to show up.
Yep.
But we never had so many people self-identify as veterans or family members of veterans as we did when we were performing in NYCHA developments. They didn't wear it on their sleeve. Mm-hmm. It wasn't their primary identity, but by virtue of the economic circumstances in which they're living and also the immigrant status of many people, there was a tremendous number of people who had served. And we were reaching them, I think, in a novel way. They weren't the people who carry the flag around on Veterans Day.
Yeah.
They're ordinary Americans.
Right.
And so I felt like we really succeeded because we trusted that if we move past the idea of the veteran being the person who walks around with a IAVA card, and thought more broadly about the communities in which veterans find themselves living, like a NYCHA development, we actually, reached veterans that would never have been reached before. And it changed us, and it changed the politics of the organization. It changed me on a fundamental level, The primary thesis of our work is those who have skin in the game, those who've experienced suffering and loss, have more to teach us than we to teach them.
Definitely.
And the deeper we went into more and more underserved communities, the more they taught us. And that's not just lip service. I mean, many of you were there and saw from DVS the profound insights that were coming from these communities, communities mostly of color, communities of immigrants, communities who were not necessarily the ones who were thought of as the primary consumers of culture or theater, teaching us what theater actually is.
Definitely.
And what it's about.
And that's such a perfect kind of segue. So we're also joined here by another fellow DVSer. So we also have Monique Rada, who's one of our engagement community specialists. She's out in the community engaging with the folks. She works pretty closely with Brian on the projects that the DVS and Theater of War have done over the last 2+ years. So Monique, welcome. Really glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So to Brian's last point, I kind of want to just have you expound on that a little bit. You know, he talked about going into these communities, typically underserved populations, and just the way that they reacted to these projects. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about your experience in both putting these, helping them bring these projects to life, but also what you've seen kind of on the ground, on the front lines out there.
To be honest, although I'm a veteran myself, it was really the projects that dealt with racial issues and those kind of concerns that really resonated with me personally. Just going to hear after the performances, so like one in particular is Antigone and Ferguson, that just was so impactful. And Brian did his a residency there briefly for a few weeks at the Harlem Stage Theater, and it was just so impactful. You listen to the choirs, you listen to the music, and you hear the performances, and you see, and it's so raw, and it's so touching, but it's the conversation, the ability to be vulnerable in that kind of a space that really changes and shifts the focus, right? So you're here, you're listening to this performance, but I found myself feeling moved to speak because I have a son, and dealing with the racial climate that we're in right now, it can be concerning and disheartening. So to have Brian see his team actually have these conversations and really listen, right? Because in this room, it's diverse, right? So, you know, people acknowledging that this is something, white privilege is real, but also understanding that we need to be open to having a conversation about this issue. It's profound to get people from different social economic backgrounds to come together and have these raw conversations. Really impact me in so many different ways, and it really shift my perspective on theater and access to it in my community.
Absolutely. And I'll never forget, I think one of the first times that that Brian, that you did The Drum Major Instinct here, which is a kind of a dramatic reading of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech. I think it was even over a weekend. Mo said, "Are you going?" I said, "No, I don't have to work. It's a weekend. I'm not going to go." And you know, we came back the next week, and you were blown away by it. You couldn't stop talking about it.
I couldn't. I mean, I was just so moved by the words. I mean, it's one thing to read the drum and Martin Luther King's last speech, but it's another thing to actually listen to it, to see it, to let it resonate in your mind and your heart. And then I was just moved to speak even then. So it was just, although I'm working, and I find myself feeling moved to kind of just interact. It makes you reflect and think. And it just speaks to the power of his work and the power that it can have to change and be a catalyst for change, to have conversation. It just starts there, but the goal is to have it continuously happen and to continue moving forward, pushing the needle for change. And it could just be small changes, small things in your community, small conversations that can happen to make people better.
Absolutely.
I'll just say briefly two things. One is that all the DVS staff who came to our performances became these kind of, you know, we're always looking in the audience to bring enough people with skin in the game to have credible messengers who are in the audience. Mm-hmm. But they're kind of, the DVS folks are kind of like credible healers, you know, that, you know, they've got skin in the game. Monique's got skin, multiple levels of skin in the game. Gabe, you do, everybody does in this, and that have been with us, Melissa and Tanya. And there's this incredible moment where all of a sudden, like, people on staff of the agency are speaking as human beings. And it actually is creating a bridge, right, to access for people who may not want to approach the city for any advice around services.
Right.
And that's where I think the experiment of the public artisan residency embedded in the agency has been a real success, because we've learned, you know, there are so many reasons why people won't walk through that door and seek help. But seeing the people who are holding up the resources and saying, we know where you can go,
right,
as human beings, yep, first, not as city employees.
Yeah, because yeah, it shifts the lens from this is a representative of a municipal agency to now this is just another person of my community with whom I can connect.
Exactly. And so that's one thing. And I think the other is that I keep coming back to this idea that this millennial generation, and post-millennial that has been through the last 18 years of conflict, is changing the face of mental health care in the country, not because they're all training to become psychologists or psychiatrists, not because they're all doing group therapy, but because this generation demands to have the conversation.
Mm.
So as hard as it sounded to get them to talk back when we did that first Theater of War, I don't think it's a coincidence. I think if we had done Theater of War for even the Vietnam generation or the World War II generation, we've had folks, and they wouldn't necessarily have known to meet it.
Right.
That's what I mean by the right time and the right place. The reason that first conversation lasted 3.5 hours is because those Marines are from a generation that now has the tools, the ability, and the desire to name the unnameable, to speak it. And even though it was a risk, career-ending possible risk at that time, and the Army and Marine Corps and Navy handbooks have changed, it's because of this generation. And it's not just a generation of veterans, it's a generation of medical residents that say, we're not sure this system of hazing that is necessary for training good doctors.
Yep.
Let's interrogate what it means to be indoctrinated,
right,
as an adult. I think this is an amazing opportunity led by veterans who are at the front lines of mental health, never had a cohort this large ever come back from a war and want to talk about it.
Right.
To change the face of mental health, not just in our country, but around the world, because we perform internationally and most other countries don't want to talk about it at the level that we now, as a culture, left and right, all agree we need more mental health conversations. We need more resources and communities. And that's where I think what's so exciting about what DVS has been doing, our collaboration, and also what we've done with PAIR over the last 2 years, because we've widened the conversation to many other issues, but driven by veterans and driven by this unique young cohort of veterans.
Absolutely. So to wrap up here, this has been this is a really great conversation. I'm so glad we were able to chat. If there's one thing that you wish you could tell kind of every New York City veteran service member, what would that be?
You know, I think the New York City veterans community is very it's dispersed. It doesn't feel like a one community. It seems like the one thing that the veteran community does do is march in the parade.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots and lots of organizations, and I think it can feel in this big city very isolating to be a veteran. And I just want more and more people to know about this agency and what it's taking on and its ambition and its agenda and its vision for, not treating veterans like victims, but seeing their potential and bringing it to a larger audience. I'm just excited about, what lies in front of DVS in the years to come in terms of, you know, standing up from basically an office to now a full agency.
Definitely.
So if more people could know about what you guys are doing, I think that community will start to come together in ways that it hasn't
historically. What about for the folks who maybe don't necessarily have a direct connection to the military? What would you tell them?
I mean, I think there's more that unites us than divides us. And this time of fracture and political divides, you know, we in New York City in particular have this unique opportunity to show the country and the world what it means not just to live up against one and each other, but what it means to truly be neighbors and community members and citizens and leaders. So I think, you know, there's a real opportunity, and I really think that veterans lead the way.
Absolutely.
And no matter what you think about war, what do you think about foreign policy decisions our country has made, I put my money on those with skin in the game, and those who put their lives on the line. They have the insights
For sure.
You know, that we need to listen to.
So, but yeah, like I said, Brian, this has been a real treat. If folks want to get a hold of you or the organization, or how would they do that? Website, email, social media?
Very simple. Theaterofwar.com is our website. Our full schedule is up. We're going to be adding a lot of dates over the next 6 to 8 months, a lot in New York City. Mm-hmm. We're about to embark on a new residency. All of our projects are free.
Yep.
All of our projects are open to the public. If they're in a restrictive place, there's a way on our website you can just write to us, can I come with you to the prison, and we'll try to find you a way in. Can awesome. You come to the military base? So that's the best place, theaterofwar.com. We hope to see you there, and we hope to see you at one of our events.
Great. Thanks so much. And Monique, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Monique, like I said earlier, is one of our community engagement specialists. She's in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Pretty much 4 or 5 days a week.
That's right.
So if you want to connect with Monique, you could reach out to DVS, and we'll definitely put you in touch with her. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Cheers.